I'm Dan Runcie, and you're listening to Trapital, where today we're going to talk all about music streaming, which is arguably the best bang for your buck consumer subscription product in all of the internet. For $12 a month, you have access to virtually every song that's been made ad-free at the tip of your fingers. And it comes at a price that's less than half what Netflix is about to raise its prices to. And that difference right there has been a huge pain point for the executives at the major and indie labels that have been eagerly trying to find ways to get consumers to pay more for the music that they love. And that brings us to the recent news about Spotify Music Pro. This is the new premium tier that the company is exploring to launch later in 2025 that may be priced around $18 a month that could include features like premium audio, the ability to speed up or slow down or adjust and edit songs, and early access to concert presale tickets for the biggest artists in the world. This news comes after years of discussions about what a super fan or premium tier could look like, and this is the furthest development that we've had to date. So it's a great opportunity to talk about super fans, what they really want, what the music industry wants, what the streaming services want, and whether this proposed product will address those needs. So come join me and Tati Sirisano from Media Research as we break it all down. Let's dive in. This episode of Trapital is brought to you by our friends at BeatBread, who just launched a game changer. They have a new deal comparison tool that lets artists and labels compare all of their offers in one place. You can see the fees, recoupment, and cash flows across several performance scenarios. There are more people than ever who want to fund your music. Record labels, investment firms, distributors, and more. The best deal for you long-term might not be the first one you get or the one that looks the best in a term sheet. Make the right choice. BeatBread's mission is to help you make the smartest choice, even if that's not a deal from BeatBread. You can get started at beatbread.com/compare. That's BEATBREAD.com/compare. Or you can click the link in our show notes. Hey, I have some big, big announcements coming up. I can't share all the details just yet, but put this date in your calendar, September 10th, 2025. That's all I can say right now. Put that date in your calendar, September 10th, 2025. More to come soon. All right, we're here with Tati Sirisano from Media Research, and we're going to dig into the sexiest topic of all, premium tiers in music streaming subscriptions.
Very top of mind these days for a lot of people, myself included. So excited to chat.
I do have to say, every time that I get a notice or see something about Netflix raising its prices, I have to imagine that people, understandably, that work in music have to be like, what the hell? Come on. We're getting pushback and our price isn't even half of what that's about to be.
It doesn't seem to have really negatively affected any of these video streaming services to be raising their prices. And I think about, especially when we talk about like price sensitivity and stuff, I'm always trying to put the lens back to myself and say, oh, would I pay for this thing? And have I been upset about price increases? Because I do so much work as an analyst, like studying the consumer.
What about you? What service do you use? And are you on a solo plan, family plan? What do you currently pay for music?
Yeah, I'm on a Spotify premium plan. Actually, I have Amazon Prime Music because I have Amazon Prime, but I'm not using it as much as I use Spotify. That's it when it comes to music. I could be on a family plan too. I could figure that out and I haven't. So that's another thing. Like just sometimes it's like the laziness factor.
I'm on the Spotify duo plan. So my wife and I use that. They continuously send the prompts to say, oh, hey, they're essentially saying, we see you listen to a lot of kids' music. Do you want to do a family plan? It almost feels like more friction to do the work of changing the subscription
the
than actually doing it, right?
Yeah.
And this is just us two, which obviously we skew more to people that would probably be willing to either pay for these things or be less price sensitive than others, which I think is relevant for this conversation, which is the furthest development that we've had to date about super fan tiers and what that may look like, with Bloomberg's report about Spotify Music Pro. So when you first read this, what was your take on it?
I was really curious to see what features would be included. I know this is still as reported and not confirmed, but I thought that the live music presale totally makes sense and was something I would have expected. We've done a lot of work in surveys looking at what are the things that consumers are willing to pay extra for when it comes to music streaming, and early access and exclusive access to either the music itself, the merch, or the tickets always comes out on top. So I thought that one made sense. The remixing or editing songs, I did not expect to be in there, but is something that I think is a really great idea. I didn't expect it to be in there just knowing the licensing complexities of getting a product like that off the ground. So I thought that was really cool. But I did think overall, I appreciated the product's mix was catering to a couple of different versions of what it means to be a music fan and to express that fandom. I thought it was cool that it was catering to these different types, because that's something that I sometimes am concerned with the push on fandom, is that we're bucketing all fans into this one category when actually there's so many different ways to be a fan and to express that.
The one thing I do want to start with, though, is maybe what isn't here, which was long discussed as the potential attractive feature for Superfan tier, which is giving music listeners early access to listen to a song or an album from their favorite artist. This was talked about for a while. I had heard the heads of different DSPs have talked to me personally and went back and forth about this. Earlier reports and developments about Superfans always tease this around, but it isn't in this report that we saw from Bloomberg. Do you have a take or sense on why you think that is? Not necessarily from what you may have heard or not heard, but more from thinking about why this may not have landed, given that this was something that was kicked around for so long.
I think that the conversations about it have changed a lot as the streaming landscape has changed a lot. It was still not early days of streaming, but it was still a time when the goal was getting as many people onto streaming as possible. And I think maybe there was a fear that by limiting access this much, it was like a rising tide lifts all boats type of mentality, where it's like, we need to have all the content available everywhere to get as many people adapted to streaming as possible. And then we can start innovating in these other ways. I think there was also this fear, maybe more from the label side, that people would just rip the music that was available early and just share it everywhere anyway, and then they would miss out. I think that those fears are a little bit overblown and not as relevant today, because I think that the incentive for the people that would be signing up for the early access is such that they wouldn't want to share the thing they're getting access to and then reduce the value of it. I think that there was also maybe this fear in the past of, if you only release the album to this specific set of people for the first 2 weeks or whatever, that you're gonna lessen the impact, like you won't make as big a splash. And I think that fear is also slightly lessened these days, where the focus is less on making a big splash for everyone and more on finding your target audience and landing there. There's very few digital entertainment experiences that are scarce, and so they're not seen as valuable or that something that demands that high of a premium. And early access to music is a way to inject some of that scarcity back into the market. And I think that's needed. So I think that it's a good idea, but I understand that there's a lot of complexities to actually put it into motion.
I think I look at the impact, and you mentioned that when artists want to release their music, there's a lot of earned media and bonuses and market share that goes into having the most streams possible to have the biggest charting release possible.
That's a great point.
Streams that are on free tiers and video tiers and paid and unpaid. And sure, some of those things obviously end up being weighted once you do the math and figure out how much revenue it is. But streaming equivalent albums don't differentiate between those certain types of nuances in that type of way. Of course, there's the free versus paid, but it doesn't get more granular than that. So there's arbitrage opportunity in doing that. And I think anytime you limit that, it does get a bit tough. And you mentioned with the exclusives, yes, it's great for the artist if they got a $20 million check from Apple or Tidal or whoever to have their music early there, but they also lost out on having the number one album of the week. Obviously, Drake or Beyonce didn't, but several others may have felt like they did by doing that. So I think it can limit the pool in that way. So I think that's one thing on the artist side and on the label side, frankly, because of all the incentives that are tied to dominating the charts. But on the fan side of it, the challenge is fans are a bit picky and choosy, understandably so, about who they would want to pay that type of access to have. And if their favorite artist is only releasing music once every few years, or even if people may be multiple super fans of different people, it's all relative. You're asking someone to make a recurring subscription for something in their mind is a bit more of a one-time purchase, at least for that particular item, which makes the economics of it fall off. And I think that also applies to the concert ticket presale piece, which we can talk about. But I think that those two reasons are why this has been a rub. And even if you look at Spotify itself, they tried some of this. I remember when Adele was releasing some album and she didn't want it to be released first to the subscribers that were on the free tier. She wanted it to be on the paid tier first. And they've tried stuff like this and it just doesn't work as well as we think it would. Otherwise, it would be in practice much more often than it is.
It's a really good point, both of them. But on the fan side, like, there is the risk of backlash from your fan base, especially in this environment where I think a lot of fans are hypersensitive to what they're being charged for everything, with live tickets and merch being a big part of that. So I think there is also the risk that some fan bases would say, how dare you charge me more to access this music when I'm just a fan? I think that, yeah, sometimes that's a greater risk overall when we talk about monetizing fandom, is you don't want it to feel to the fan like you're just squeezing out every last bit of money from them.
We should talk about the premium audio piece of it. I agree that I don't see that as big of a selling point because that is a option that's available on other services besides Spotify. And those haven't been compelling enough things to get a large number of people to subscribe for those products either. So if it's thrown in as a feature, sure, it's a nice to have. But dating back to the Napster days and people comparing that, oh, MP3 quality music isn't anywhere near what you have on a CD, the average consumer can't tell and doesn't care. And that was the case 25 years ago, and that's still the case today.
And a lot of these things, I think people, what they do notice, have come to expect as just like the natural evolution of products, the same way that like the iPhone resolution that I have now is better than what I had 5 years ago. I think part of it is just something that people now expect to improve over time without them having to pay extra for it.
And frankly, the difference isn't like that big. Let's talk about audio from a podcasting perspective. If you listen to the episodes of Trapital from 2019 versus now, yes, you could hear a big difference in the audio quality. But again, the difference of the tools that were being used and what the room setup is like and everything that's there is a much bigger difference than Spotify regular tier and Spotify or Apple Music or Amazon's hi-fi, high-fidelity audio tiers on their respective platforms.
You also made me think of that issue is that you don't know what you are missing. So if you were to try hi-fi audio and it actually did sound much better, then you might say, oh, okay, I do want to pay extra for this. But if you've never tried it, there's not enough of an incentive to pay because you don't really know what you're missing. You might be like, oh, but it sounds fine to me. It's that thing where you don't know until you try it, and getting people to try it is friction.
And I'm sure that there's some audiophile listening to this episode that's probably nails on a chalkboard hearing me say something like that. But again, that isn't everyone. And not that this product needs to appeal to everyone, but it still needs to appeal to enough people to move the needle with this. So let's talk about the ability to edit and adapt these songs, whether it's speeding up, slow down, essentially the TikTokification of this. Do you think that's enough of a selling point here? Do you think that it reaches the right audience for this type of product? What's your take?
So I think that there is a market for having this ability to edit and remix songs that people love in the same places that they consume them, because we're already seeing that even without a feature available on platforms like TikTok, where people are already doing this without the licensing, without the money going back to the right rights holder and all that. It's already happening. So the use case is clear. I think the struggle with implementing it on streaming platforms, though, is that my impression is that a big part of this activity is about sharing it. It's not just the process of remixing the song or editing it, slowing it down, speeding it up. It's about doing that and then sharing it with people. And better yet, sharing it in a multidimensional way, which is on top of video. Having the ability to do this in isolation on a streaming service only scratches like a little bit of that itch. It doesn't go as far as I think it needs to be successful. So I'm skeptical of how big of a draw that could be without having some sort of social component.
Spotify doesn't have social platforms or doesn't have the social engagement features that would make this work. One of the challenges, though, and this is something that we probably didn't talk about, is that this is a product that is primarily popular with a demographic that hasn't been as readily eager to sign up for Spotify itself as a core product.
Totally.
Everyone's talked about Gen Z and how Gen Z doesn't necessarily subscribe to a lot of these services, and whether it's Spotify or even Netflix or some of these other services, everyone's trying to figure out, okay, how do you pull Gen Z off of TikTok? So it's a product that makes sense, but you're now trying to price it at an even higher price point when the audience that was largely using this type of feature in their music wasn't paying for it to begin with.
Yeah, and you're also asking your users to use the platform in a fundamentally different way than they have been. Spotify and these other DSPs, they're predominantly like a platform that you open and you press play on what you need and then you minimize it. The encouragement on a platform like Spotify is, we'll do the work for you. We have these recommendations. We have the AI DJ. You don't need to spend your time searching around the platform. And so with the editing feature, the remixing feature, you're asking people to also just fundamentally change how they engage with the platform, which could be tricky.
And you and I've talked about that in our Meta episode, TikTok, any of these other examples. Changing consumer behavior when they're used to using a platform in a certain way is always difficult.
And I think that not just when it comes to the song editing, but when it comes to these super fan tiers in general is a challenge for streaming, because so much of the streaming experience is intended to be lean back. And now we're asking people to lean forward, and you can't necessarily expect them to just jump into that new way of using the platform. It might take time.
So let's talk about the last element here, which is the ticket presale piece. And yes, this is something that is interesting because Spotify has started and paused its own ticketing efforts over time. I think the one thing that does feel a little bit difficult, though, with pre-sales is it's important to have some context for how pre-sales work in a traditional sense with an artist that is about to go on tour. So a lot of these discussions happen between the events promoter and the credit card companies or the company that's offering the pre-sale itself. Artists do likely have some influence one way or another because, as we know, there's certain artists that have done certain partnerships with others, like Kendrick Lamar has partnered with Cash App. He did it with the Big Steppers tour. He's about to do it with this GNX tour that he's going to go on with SZA. Taylor Swift, of course, has had this longstanding Capital One relationship. In many ways, it's the credit card companies that pay several million dollars in order to have access to that pre-sale. And especially for the biggest artists in the world, it's oftentimes just one company that ends up getting it. So if they're paying for that, though, the credit card companies are usually doing this to get brand recognition, to be able to use that as their own type of marketing, to be able to get more customers into their funnel, because you often have to use their credit cards to get tickets in general. So it's a way for them to do that. The dynamics and the relationship between supplier and merchant and retailer feel a little bit different here, because now you're asking the fan to pay more for this type of thing. So then that money is then going to be relayed, then pushed through Spotify to then go to the events promoter. Like,
right.
How do each of these things work in that way? And I know that Spotify has done pre-sales for some of the artists that had done direct deals, but if you're trying to push something like a super fan product and you're trying to get the biggest artists in the world, and again, some of them already have their relationships that they've had for years, getting them to either not do the full pre-sale with one particular merchant or credit card company, or to split it up or have part of it with Spotify, it just doesn't seem like there's a likely scenario where it's, oh yeah, Beyonce tickets are now going to be available to everyone on pre-sale that has a Spotify account. I just don't see it working in that kind of way. Let's take a break for our Chartmetric stat of the week. Billboard reported that the Red Hot Chili Peppers are seeking a whopping $350 million for its recorded music catalog. If you add that with the $150 that the band got for its share of its publishing 4 years ago, that would be a whopping $500 million total that the band has gotten off of its music rights. While I don't think the number will quite be that high, this deal is still fascinating for a few reasons. When you look at a lot of these catalog deals, I often put them in two groups. They're the artists or the acts that have one, two, or three big hits, and that's what drives the whole bus. But then there's others that have a true deep catalog, and Red Hot Chili Peppers definitely falls in that latter group. You look at the songs that do the best on Spotify and YouTube, Californication is at the top, but the other ones like Other Side and Snow and others aren't too far behind. But if you look on radio play, it's Under the Bridge by far that's the top performing one. And this is a band that's still actively touring. And again, one of the benefits of buying and investing in a catalog that has some true track record is that a number of songs can do well on different platforms. Let's get back to the episode.
I have a lot of similar questions, and do not have the answers about that relation, those relationships, supplier and customer and all that. I think that you're right, though, with what you hinted at with from the fan's point of view, there's this risk that it could be viewed as, wait a minute, like you're asking me to pay more to pay for this thing that is already super contentious when it comes to price with live tickets more expensive than ever. I think when you think about it that way, there is the risk, again, of fans feeling taken advantage of.
Right. And here's a quote from Michael Rapino, CEO founder of Live Nation, that had talked about in a recent earnings call where he commented on them exploring and having conversations with Spotify, Apple, and Amazon about this. He said that, quote, it wouldn't surprise me, of course, if they are trying to add a $5 premium to a monthly subscription and they don't have enough of their own inventory in terms of music or free songs. It's always the easy go-to. Let's give them pre-sale access. The hard part about pre-scale is just scaling it. Everybody wants the Beyonce pre-sale, and that's hard to scale, end quote. Or even Cash App getting in the business the way that they did made a pretty big statement. But again, they also had a track record of doing these influencer promotions with different artists and hip-hop and things like that. So there's a natural segue there. Spotify, of course, touches more fans and has more data about consumption habits in terms of listening than anyone, but it's still a bit tough there. So that brings us to this, right? So we went through each of the 3 points. We have skepticisms on each of them. We talked about the one that probably would be the most valuable, which is not here for obvious reasons. And it's easy to question, okay, why does this exist the way that it is? Who is this really for? We understand that the labels likely wanted this. The labels likely pushed Spotify to have something like this. And when I say Spotify, it clearly isn't just them. It would likely be introduced at the other DSPs as well. But how do we actually see this playing out? The goal is to have 20 or 30% of the people that currently pay for a music subscription in the world, which is over 500 million people, at least from the numbers that I've seen. Is the goal is to get 100 million people to pay for a product like this, regardless of what service they subscribe to? I don't see it at all.
Yeah, I think that the 20 to 30% is extremely high. I also think even to get to 10% will take a lot of time. It's not like this is something that the feature is launched and then overnight or even within the first year. We just talked about how there's so many unknowns in the presale, but there's also unknowns just in terms of, would it be for all the artists? Would it be for select artists? What exactly would be included? Because when I try to do the test of would I subscribe to this thing, the answer is it depends. It depends on if I can share those songs. What can I do with them? So yeah, it's hard to tell.
Because you and I, of course, being least price sensitive, not necessarily in terms of income, but because of what we do for a living, if folks like us are like, I don't know.
Right.
That's not a good indication for everyone else, because we should be the hell yeses and everyone else down along the adoption curve should be somewhere between no and yes on that, right? If we're already like, that does not bode well for others that are less tapped in.
Is there a feature for you that you would be like, hell yes?
At this point, probably not, because I think I primarily subscribe to these services out of convenience, speaking specifically on the audio side. And I do think that if the end goal here is to find a way to justifiably charge $18 per month and charge something that feels more in line with what Netflix or Max or other SVOD services charge, isn't it probably easier to just do 2 price hikes a year and maybe do them at $2 and then by 2027, it's $18 a month? Again, that may seem aggressive, but you're comparing yourself to the SVOD services. They have no problem increasing prices 2 times in a calendar year. Music is obviously different for reasons you and I have talked about. Netflix doesn't have the YouTube dynamic where all of its content is available ad-free. So there is a bit of a anchoring there that keeps music priced much lower than Netflix in that way. You can't watch Stranger Things ad-free on YouTube for free the same way that you can listen to Kendrick Lamar's whole album on YouTube in that way.
I feel similarly, with the exception of, I think that exclusives would change the game for me, but that's the hardest thing to achieve.
Like, when you say exclusives, what do you mean?
Exclusive music. What artist wants to hide their music from people? They probably want it to be available to everyone, unless it's the sort of thing where the artist is releasing just demos or tracks that didn't make the album. But even then, a lot of artists don't want that out there. So I think from the artist side, it's a hard sell. I think the consumer side, it would be a big draw for a lot of people, but I don't know. Maybe there is then those fears that everything would just get ripped and put online anyway. I think my sort of wishful, if I could make any feature happen right now, it would be exclusive for all 3 of those, but I don't think it's necessarily going to happen.
I get that. Another question here, though, is obviously we've been talking about this in terms of a Spotify thing. Do you see the likelihood of success, failure, or how this ends up being both received and used any different on those platforms, given what we know about how they're different from Spotify?
Yeah, I think the demographic of the users is really key there, because whenever you're dealing with products that monetize fandom, the demographic matters a lot, because you need your target audience to be young enough that music is really key to their identity and they're willing to buy things to express it, but also old enough to have disposable income to spend on things like live tickets and merch, the Gen Z millennial sort of overlap. And Spotify and Apple Music have that. Amazon's demographic is a little bit older, so these types of products might be a harder sell. I think that all of the platforms have strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, I think the nuance here is that the Apple and Amazon subscribers are the least price sensitive, in my opinion. So they're likely more willing to pay $18 a month in general for music streaming. But this particular option with the features that we've discussed is probably the least compelling to them, because this is the audience that is less likely to edit and adapt their music because of what you just said. This is also the audience that, okay, could they care more about premium audio? And then third, with the concert presale, yes, this audience likely will spend more on concert tickets than Spotify or another service. But again, are they going to concerts as much as the Spotify user? And then it becomes a bit of a frequency thing. Are you asking someone to make a recurring monthly purchase for something that feels more like a one-time purchase when you actually need it, especially if you may only be going to two or three shows per year if you're a subscriber of one of those services?
Yeah, and then there's, of course, Spotify is an independent company, whereas Apple and Amazon are Apple and Amazon. But the Apple and Amazon have more flexibility with potentially undercutting Spotify on the price of these things, which is also a risk.
True.
For Spotify, yeah.
Another part, too, that we should talk about is the branding of anything related to a price increase from a company like Spotify, because whether it's warranted or not warranted, I think a lot of average consumers may see any type of price increase as, oh, here we go again. Spotify is now taking more of my money. Is this money going to go back to the artist?
Right.
And how many times have you and I heard that narrative? You and I obviously know that's not necessarily how it works. And ultimately, more of that money would go back to the artist because of how the payouts work. But how the money ends up getting split, this additional $6 is likely the cause for a whole nother round of negotiations between major record labels and the streaming services too. But again, I think that it can be hard to get consumers to understand that, oh no, this isn't really a Spotify thing. This is a major record label thing. And they're trying to do this on behalf of the artists that they represent and their rights holders. And Spotify is more so doing this because they feel somewhat pushed to be like, all right, fine, we'll bend to the will and make a concession here, even if we do or don't think this is actually going to work. That's my take on it. But again, like, we're people that are tapped into this. I don't know if that's going to land with the consumer that couldn't name the big three record labels if they tried and thinks that Spotify is the problem.
Yeah. And the pricing analysis is really interesting. I've been getting into this very recently with my coworker, Perry Gresham. He and I have been working on this study of exactly this topic of what is the optimum price for a super fan tier on streaming. There's maybe this idea that if you raise the price on something, you automatically make more money. But we quickly see in this model that we're working on, that's not the case. So pricing analysis and pricing sensitivity is a really deep subject with a lot of nuance. Everything is not what it seems when it comes to this. And it's not just simply if you raise the price, you make more money.
And I think we saw this 4 or 5 years ago when Spotify and the other DSPs' growth was booming. There were far less complaints about the price being $9.99 a month when the book of business is growing 20% year over year. And it's hard to ignore the success that came from that. But now when growth has stalled for premium subscriptions in the US, regardless of whether it's Spotify or any of the others that we've named, there is more pressure on this, right? So now it feels like some of the conversation feels, oh, it's overdue that we, how is it still this way? It's this way because that's how we got to the point of nearly 500 million people paying for music in a way that they weren't before.
Yeah.
But moving forward, though, and how we see this playing itself out, if we know that the end goal here is a service like Netflix is $24.99 a month or soon will be, Spotify sees itself as a peer to that, wants it to be priced as much. And when I say Spotify, I should more so say the major record labels want Spotify to be priced as much, because it's more so them making these comments, not necessarily Spotify leadership making these comments. What's the best way to get there beyond just the price raises? Because of course, I do believe that is probably one of the more likely ways. But if they're really trying to create a product that super fans do want and are willing to pay and consume on the platform of how they use Spotify, what is the most likely thing that they would be willing to pay for?
Yeah, it's not just having a premium tier for super fans, but also maybe even exploring tiers that are a little bit limited and cost less. We also have seen this in our surveys that there's a good chunk of people that just will never pay $11.99. They just won't. They don't listen to enough music. But if is there something that we could offer them that was a light tier for a little bit less and capture them there? So I think we are at the point where it's not just about, oh, we got to raise the prices, but it's also about just further segmentation.
That's where I've landed too. And you saw a bit of this with YouTube Premium Lite. I think let's say that you were someone that already paid for a music streaming service, but you wanted to watch ad-free video services. There wasn't a happy medium unless you were paying double for something one way or another. So They introduced this product. We'll see how successful it is, but yeah, it's priced at this $6 to $8 range that we're talking about. Bringing this back to Spotify and the other DSPs, I do think that Rob Stringer had mentioned something like this in a recent earnings call, but what about introducing a lower price tier that does have some ads, similar to what we saw from Spotify? You do that, allows you to do two things. One, you can price that much more competitively, even cheaper than what Spotify was when it first launched. We're talking about Amazon in the beginning of this conversation. Some of those initial prices for Amazon Music were so cheap when it first launched. I'm talking like $3.99 or $7.99 if you already had a Prime account. And then there were different tiers if you had Amazon Prime Unlimited versus just regular Amazon Prime Music. So if you have something that is priced competitively there, it gives you the option to capture that demand from that type of listener. Yeah. But then it also gives you opportunity to raise the price even more so on the actual premium thing that you want. Because if your introductory price is not the $24.99, but it's actually some $7.99 tier, you already talk so much about comparing yourself to Netflix, you might as well do the same strategy.
And speaking of Amazon, I feel like Amazon Music is the streaming service that has the most segmentation, or at least it appears to be. Like, they have a subscription if you have this certain number of devices, and there's the unlimited. Like, there's so many options depending on who you are and what you want.
It feels a bit clunky at times, to be frank.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to bring up, is the downside to that is it becomes really confusing to navigate as a consumer. So I think there's also that risk, but that is an example of a company that has gone really deep into segmentation in a way that others haven't.
On a scale of 1 to 10, if that's a 10, how do you have yours be like, okay, we obviously need to add in a few different options. And to be honest, even Netflix is a bit confusing, because it's, oh, there's just like super HD one and there's this regular HD one. I get it. It's probably going to be a little convoluted either way, but that's likely where we're going. And to be fair, there probably may be more developments from here on out.
I also think we're never going to know unless we start experimenting. And I think this is something that's been talked about for so long. I'm interested and excited to see like actual movement in the space.
We can't go off of a report from several sources. We got to see something that's actually to pay for. So we will have to revisit this when the time comes. Thanks, Tati. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Dan.
And that's a wrap. That's our breakdown on Superfan tiers, Spotify, Music Pro, and what to expect moving forward. Thank you, Tati, again for joining me on this one. Thank you to our producers, G and Eric, for everything that you do for both the audio and video to help make this show possible. And thank you for listening. Again, as we always ask, if there's one person you know that you think would really enjoy this episode or enjoy listening to all of the episodes and the type of conversations we have on Trapital, if you could share this podcast and this episode with them, that would be tremendously appreciated. And if you have the time, if you can rate and review the show on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether it's Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, I would really appreciate it. Thanks again. Talk to you next time.
Hello, podcast listeners. I have a question for you. What if you had a window into the digital startup world? What if you could ask the tech veterans what it feels like to create a world-class product? How to recover from critical mistakes? How to scale your solution to the masses? How do you get from an idea on the back of a napkin to a fully functioning product? What if you could hear the human stories about how they delivered technology? What if there was a show where you could hear those stories?
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
Spent 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing on the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know
Just
what
took
to do next.
Many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
A company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve
Most
more.
Proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a
Yes,
pain.
We've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time.
The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, mind
you. Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want
it. It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story.
Make sure you subscribe to the Code Story podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And thanks again for listening.